La la la. No. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's very special lunch talk. Before we begin our journey to the land of Renaissance art, poetry, and fine wine, may I please remind you all to switch off your mobile devices and also to take a look at our website for upcoming events. We are in the middle of a very busy week. Unfortunately, the Michael Palin and Joan Chang events are both full, but we still have a few seats left for Thursday's lunch talk by one of China's most influential foreign policy experts, Yang Jianmian, senior fellow at the Shanghai Institute for International Studies, who's going to talk about foreign policy under the new leadership. He is, of course, also the brother of Yang Jiehu, China's previous foreign minister. Now, without further delay, may I present to you Dr. Alessandro Schiavo, Consul General of Italy to Hong Kong and Macau, on bringing Botticelli to Hong Kong.
Okay. Dear friends, first of all, let me thank the FCC for organizing and for hosting this lunch, and all of you for being here today and for your interest and participation. I'm really happy to have been invited. Can you hear me in the back? Yes? Yeah, okay, good, thank you. I'm really happy to have been invited to this talk to be able to speak about two projects which are very dear to my heart. The first one is the book on the history of the Italian community, which is the first one to have ever been written on our community. And the second one is the Botticelli exhibition, which is currently held at the Hong Kong U Museum under the patronage of Mrs. Pensiho. I began to cultivate these two projects in my mind soon after my arrival to Hong Kong in mid-2010, because I realized how old and how long-standing and also how important our ties with Hong Kong and Macau are, and yet how much little known our contribution has been. And also because one of the factors which affected my order of priority the most, was the realization of how much Italian culture had been for a long, long time quite underrepresented in Hong Kong, especially if you compare it with the volume, our trade volume, which is really the evidence of a considerable success. The Italian exports to Hong Kong are much higher than the ones to South Korea, Saudi Arabia, India, and Brazil, which are all very important partners for us. And yet, Italian heritage has been a little bit absent from the Hong Kong cultural scene for a long, long time. So I began to cultivate these two dreams to promote a deeper awareness of the value of Italians, of the contribution of Italians, and of the great potential for our cultural cooperation with Hong Kong. So basically, these two projects wish to convey some very few simple messages. And this is also why we created the Italian Cultural Institute 2 years ago. Now, the messages we wanted to convey are, Italy is here. We are devoted and committed to promote more of our culture here in Hong Kong. We do so because we really want to start a dialogue with the Hong Kong people, because we believe that Hong Kong is not only a place to exchange goods, but also a venue to exchange ideas. And then culture is really fundamental and instrumental for the progress of a society, of a given society. In other words, we think that Hong Kong deserves a richer and wider and more diversified cultural offer, and we really wish to share it with Hong Kong people and with its youth. But some of you may ask, why did you choose this Botticelli painting, particularly this painting, to start this process? The answer is that because we couldn't possibly think of a more beautiful, more significant masterpiece to share with the Hong Kong community. I mean, this painting is a true icon of Renaissance, and it is a true icon also of Italian art. And Renaissance was a unique time in history when painters were discovering perspective out of the new belief that man could dominate nature and space. philosophers, music composers, painters and sculptors embellished the life of the many republics in Italy, which at that time were gaining more and more economic power. They were trading with the rest of the world, were funding the best, you know, the first banks in Europe. And they were creating, you know, a movement of rebirth, because this is the real meaning of the word Rinascimento, Renaissance, rebirth. They were creating a movement of rebirth which really brought about a real and profound explosion of art, which was destined to spread throughout all Europe, and also to have a deep influence and act as a source of inspiration even in our day and age. So this is the meaning of Renaissance for us. The cradle of this literary, philosophical, and artistic revolution was Florence, where geniuses of the caliber of Botticelli himself, of course, but also Leonardo da Vinci, Brunelleschi, Donatello, just to mention but a few, were giving start to the new era of civilization and of hope for the entire mankind after the somber Middle Ages. Sandro Botticelli worked at the court of Lorenzo il Magnifico, the Magnificent. Lorenzo was a descendant of the rich and wealthy Medici's family, one of the most powerful in Europe, which had the biggest bank in Europe at the time, with branches all over the continent. And they owned a textile industry, which at that time employed 10,000 workers. Lorenzo was a poet, a music composer, a philanthropist, and a patron of arts, and of course a brilliant diplomat and one of the greatest statesmen in the whole history of Tuscany. Practically, you know, the Medicis were the most cultured, the most privileged, the most, you know, the wealthiest and most powerful family in Tuscany and also in Italy at that time. And they were the personification of the golden era of Florence. And also Lorenzo, who was, as I told you before, you know, a poet himself, drew inspiration from this very beautiful lady who is portrayed in this painting by Botticelli. So she was a very famous lady at the time. She had a name. The name was Simonetta Cattaneo. She was born in Porto Venere, or maybe she moved there when she was a child. Porto Venere is an ancient and very nice village, charming village by the sea in Liguria, which was known already in the ancient times as the Porto Venere, the Portus Veneris, which literally means the harbor of Venus. What a rare coincidence for a lady to be born in Porto Venere, a lady destined to embody and personify the ancient goddess. She was very beautiful. When she was 15, she got married with Marco Vespucci. Now, this name may be familiar to some of you. Marco Vespucci was a distant cousin of the more famous Amerigo Vespucci, under whom America is named. The Vespuccis were another very famous, wealthy family in Florence, and they were allied of the Medicis. So when Marco and Simonetta moved to Florence, because of Simonetta's beauty, you know, they kind of became the heart of the life also, the court in Florence. And even if she was married, I mean, you can look at her, she had blonde and golden hair, gray and greenish, melancholic eyes. In a few words, she was irresistible. So many, many young men, even if she was married, couldn't resist courting her and pined for her affection. Among these, there was Botticelli himself, who depicted her in this masterpiece, but also in many other paintings. Okay, for example, this is The Spring by Botticelli, and Simonetta is the one which the female figure, you know, giving the back, the shoulder to us, one of the Tre Grazie, one of these three figures dancing. And in many other paintings of that time, you know, these are also portraits of Simonetta drawn by Botticelli. And again, another painting by Botticelli. But you could find actually her figure, her face in many, many paintings of that time. Another Simonetta Cattaneo. She was really very, very famous. She was considered a sort of top model of the Renaissance, the beauty of Florence. And so among the people who desperately fell in love with her, there was also Giuliano de' Medici. Now, who was Giuliano? Giuliano was the younger brother of Lorenzo the Magnificent. And he fell so desperately in love with her that he decided to take part in a very dangerous tournament in which he really actually, you know, risked his life. just to win, to receive a surprise, a banner with the figure, the portrait of Simonetta, drawn by Botticelli himself, with the inscription La sans par, that is to say, the lady with no equal. And Giuliano managed to win this tournament. Now, this is all history. This tournament is historically documented in many books of the time. We know everything. We know when it took place, how long it lasted, who won it, how the gentlemen, the noblemen were dressed. We know that they were, you know, wearing garments and jewels and pearls, which costed a fortune. And Simonetta was proclaimed the queen of the tournament. But so the love story between Simonetta and Giuliano, which soon became a love legend in Florence, you know, and made also fantasize people in Florence for many, many decades to come, probably remained only platonic. Because, of course, I mean, just let's remember, we are in Italy in the 15th century. And, of course, the social ethics of the time would have not tolerated a different ending, so just platonic. And by the way, the neoplatonic philosophy was the one which was dominant at the court of Lorenzo the Magnificent, so one a very famous philosopher. I told you there were sculptors, painters, musicians, and philosophers at the court of the Medici. One of that was Marco Ficino, neoplatonic philosopher. Anyway, so this love story had to remain platonic. For example, when Botticelli drew this banner, thinking also of Giuliano, Simonetta was looking at the sun. The sun was the symbol of glory and of, we don't have a picture here, but we know everything because it was described in the books. The sun was the symbol of glory and virtue. And Simonetta was not looking at a Cupid, which was a little angel of God, which was defeated, and with his hands tied to a lovely tree, an olive tree, tied by golden thread, with an arch and the arrows broken at his feet. So Simonetta was married. There was nothing to do with it. Everybody loved her, and everybody were absolutely crazy of her, but they couldn't really fight for her. When Botticelli died, he expressed, in 1510, he expressed only one wish, to be buried at Simonetta's feet in the Church of Ogni Santi in Florence, which has been frescoed by Ghirlandaio. Ghirlandaio is another famous painter of the Renaissance, who also depicted Simonetta many, many, many times, like Verrocchio, like Filippo Lippi, maybe names which do not tell you anything, but they are very, very famous in Europe and in Italy. So, forgive me, please forgive me if I made all this very long digression about the tournament and everything, but it was also to answer some questions which were made to me by some students in Hong Kong. They asked me, how comes that Simonetta is naked? It's a very clever question. You know, wasn't it provocative, you know, to paint a nude, female nude at that time? You know, Italy was obviously a very, very Catholic country. People in the Renaissance, they were quite secular. It was, again, as I told you, after the Middle Ages, they began to open up their minds. And also, but what happened is that they began to look at the classic times, the classical time, the ancient myths, because they began to find a new confidence in themselves. So they began to look back at history, in history, because they wanted to recapture the glory of former, of Rome, of the ancient Rome. And they, whereas during the Middle Ages, all the classical myths were considered as a sort, as a fruit of paganism, of course, you know, all these gods, you know, and nothing to do with monotheism, so they were condemned, even if people continue to study, you know, the classical books. During the Renaissance time, rich bankers, tradesmen, noblemen began to draw inspiration from the glory of Rome, and ancient myths were considered compatible with the Christian ethics, and they considered them as the anticipation of the Christian morality. As you know, as I'm sure you know, this is, you know, the Simonetta, the Venus that we wrote to from Italy, from the Galleria Sabauda, which is very similar to the Birth of Venus, which is permanently showcased at the Uffizi, but which could never be on loan to a foreign museum. It's like, more or less, it's the same masterpiece. Botticelli really repeatedly painted her. But so the same Venus, the other famous masterpiece is the Birth of Venus. So if Venus, who is just born, so she's pure, she's simple. Her nudity has nothing to do with sexual attraction. She just represents the purity of the Christian love. According to the Neoplatonic philosophy, love was the engine of the world, was something which could approach, make people and men get closer to God and also to a deeper human knowledge. So there was nothing wrong. On the contrary, if man managed, like Giuliano, to control his lowest instincts, love could actually be instrumental for deeper knowledge. Now, I'm sorry the image is cut, but the Simonetta of the Bird of Venus comes out on a, you know, of the waves of the sea, on a seashell. Seashell is one of the symbols of pilgrimage and also of Christianity. So the idea is that as Simonetta is born from the foam of the waves, this is the Venus, the Bird of Venus, according to the classical myth, men are reborn pure after the immersion in the christening font. So there is a lot of religious idealism also in this painting. Now, of course, you don't have to read, it's not necessary to read this painting through this kind of philosophical knowledge, but the idea is that really this is compatible with the idea of Renaissance and with the depiction of perfect human bodies, which have full plastic volumes, but at the same time have almost lost some of the attributes of their humanity, because they are so perfect that they are not contaminated by reality. Here Venus is really, Simonetta is really pure, simple, nude, but really in the sense of pure, and she's so perfect that she is untouched by life, by evil, by sadness, by bad experiences. And this is another feature of Botticelli. In San Sebastiano, you see this is a martyr. But nothing to do with realism. There is no sign of physical suffering. You know, the flesh is the arrows which are jabbed in his flesh are an offense to his youth and to his beauty. But he remains pure. He's not suffering. He made his sacrifice, but in a way he's not untouched by it. This is the idea of also of the perfection of the body. I'll try to, you know, to not to take too much time, and maybe I can come back to this concepts later. Now, just to come back to Simonetta. Simonetta died when she was extremely young. She died when she was only 22 or 23 years old of tuberculosis. And the strange thing, another coincidence, is that she died exactly on the 26th of April, 76. So 1476, 2 years before the death, the assassination of Giuliano. And when she died, a huge crowd lined up at her funeral, and lined up before her casket, which was left open to allow everybody admire her beauty for the last time, a beauty totally untarnished by death. Her premature demise, her premature death, probably has also contributed in strengthening her figure, her myth. And after a half a millennium, she is still alive among us, so much alive that the Italian authorities in the year 2001-2002 selected her image, her very, very iconic image on the for the 10-cent coin of the Italian euro that you can see there. It's absolutely her. And she's still an icon and a muse because Botticelli has made her immortal. When she died, Lorenzo the Magnificent, so the great statesman, wrote her a poem, as I told you before, likening her to a star, the most beautiful star of the sky, with embellished the sky with her own splendor so much that she made all the other stars look pale in comparison. Now, I hope that I managed to give an idea of why, which was this masterpiece, to start this process of dialogue with the Hong Kong community and to launch this message that we're really the only thing that Italy, one of the things that Italy is really expecting is to promote more art and more Italian culture in Hong Kong, not only for the sake of Italy, but really because we really want to contribute to the richness of this, of the cultural life of this beautiful city. And now let me please tap briefly into the other project which is dear to my heart. This book, which we have written with the collaboration of Angelo Paratico, is not here with us today, but also of Gianni Crivellera, who is with us today. Please, Gianni, raise your hand. Don't be shy. It's shy, okay. And then I thank him for being here. And so not many people were aware of the fact that some of the first Portuguese expeditions to Asia were financed by Italian banks, for example, or of the legacy that Italian people have left on the icon of Macau itself, that is to say the St. Paul's Church. that church is actually a product of the Italian vision. It was not commissioned or built by the former Portuguese colonial power, but it was commissioned by Alessandro Valignano, who was a very famous Jesuit, one of the first ones to arrive to Macau, and probably the Italian man who had the biggest influence on Macau is still buried in the crypt of the St. Paul's Church. And the architect of the church was Spinola, so another Italian, and the people who worked at the church to make all the sculptures and everything were also directed by Giovanni Cola, who was another Italian, who founded in Macau the first school of painting which blended the Eastern and the Western styles. So 130 years, the more famous Castiglione, who was one of the famous painters of the court of the Qing Emperor. So not only did Valignano ask to build this church, which remained for a very long time the largest Catholic monument in East Asia, but also ordered the construction of the first university in East Asia, the College of St. Paul, which at that time was just by the side of the church, and it was a first place for intercultural dialogue, where missionaries from Japan, Italy, India, Portugal, Spain could meet, could learn the local languages, and familiarize with the local cultures, and generate new knowledge. Now, Valignano was the first one who said that the church had to be Indian in India, Japanese in Japan, and Chinese in China. This means that his reading of the word was so modern that he was the first one to understand that in order for the church to be successful, or for any diplomatic Western, diplomacy to be successful, the Westerners, the new people, had to be the ones who had to fit into the local culture and not the other way around. So all these people, Valignano, Matteo Ricci, Michele Ruggeri, and by the way, Valignano was the one who asked to Matteo Ricci, Limadou, and Michele Ruggeri to learn Chinese, because the church had to be Chinese in China, therefore they have to be Chinese. So all these people were, again, just to mention, for time concerns, they were the advocates of the so-called Suave method, or accommodation method, which means we have to recognize the local culture as equal. They immediately understood that China was a very ancient civilization which needed and deserved to be respected. So they came to China and to Macau as friends. Now, and they were the ones to understand that the intercultural dialogue, which is today recognized as the very basic and essential tool of any successful diplomacy, they were the ones to coin and actually implement this philosophy of soft power over 400 years ago. And what I want to stress now is that all the Italians also came after Valignano, Limadou, and Michele Ruggeri. So the Italians were the first sinologists of the Western world, of the whole world, the first ones to study Chinese and write a dictionary between Portuguese and Chinese, so between a European language and Chinese. All these people have had very good descendants in a way. Also the Italian people who came, the missionaries also who came to Hong Kong many, many centuries ago, built here hospitals and schools, among which I take the pleasure of mentioning the Canossian schools. And they, in the more recent times, some of the Pime fathers also built in Hong Kong some homes for the disabled and founded the famous Funhan Society. It has a local name, but it was founded by Italian people. An Italian priest in Hong Kong in the 50s even invented the instant noodles. Not the noodles, of course, the instant noodles. And thus deserving the title of noodles priest, of which he was very, very proud. And then also the modern businessmen, who are not as famous as the people I've just mentioned, came here with the same spirit of friendship. And they're all participants to the same spirit of friendship and fascination that the Italians have always felt for this part of the world. And what is striking, according to me, is that we never try to brand all these creations, the dictionary between in a European language which was not Italian, Portuguese and Chinese, or the Fuhan Society as Italians. We were simply content of doing the job, of doing something for the local community and to hand it over to the local community. Thank you for the attention.
Thank you so much, Alexandra. Wow, I never knew all these stories behind the famous face before. We have about 15 minutes left for Q&A. I'm going to ask my fellow board member, Cammy Yu, to kick this off, because I think you've got a burning question for Alexandra, didn't you?
I do have a burning question. I mean, of all the treasures that you could have chosen from all the repertoire of Italian masterpieces to bring to Hong Kong, what would you bring to Hong Kong if you could?
Next to me.
Yeah.
Okay. We are already preparing a second exhibition, and we hope, I mean, we definitely want it to be as beautiful as this one, and we are thinking about something completely different from Botticelli. Botticelli was a master of idealism, as I told you before, perfect bodies, you know, almost, you know, so human, but at the same time also so perfect, they do not look almost human anymore. So we will try to find, to bring a master of realism, just to, you know, to give you and to the Hong Kong public and the youth the idea of the diversity of Italian art and culture, and also so another master who actually opened the way for modernity, so for modern painting. Still is an ancient master. We do not want to start with contemporary art. We will also do so. But we really want to bring some rare masters, which are normally very, very difficult to bring because of insurance, security concerns and everything, because I think the job of the consulate and of Italian Cultural Institute is to bring, you know, to try to win hard challenges. But it will be totally different from Botticelli, not from Renaissance, let's say the era, the period which came soon after. Something as great as Botticelli, but absolutely the opposite of Botticelli.
How intriguing. questions from the floor, please. Would you please raise your hand, and then one of the staff will bring the microphone over, and it would be great if you would also give us your name and tell us who you are. I saw a hand over there on the left.
My question concerns the wider future. Now, the Italian consulate, thanks to your great leadership, has brought this beautiful work of art here, and you have perhaps plans to bring other works of art. But in many other countries of Europe, for example, not only Europe, there are collections of art, some of items from which could come here. Is there any room for manoeuvre for the consulates of other countries to join with you, join your start, to bring, in fact, a joint exhibition, one picture from each country of Europe on display to Hong Kong?
Okay, no, this is something which if I had enough time in Hong Kong, I'd love to do it. I'm afraid I would not have enough time. I will go, I think, after summer or soon before summer to somewhere else. But I contributed to organize something like that at the Quirinale Palace, the Palace of the Presidency of the Republic in Rome, for an important anniversary, actually for the signing of the European Constitution. So some years ago, we decided to bring one masterpiece from each country of the European Union to Rome, where the treaty was signed. So I've done it already. It's very challenging. It's extremely complicated, and it takes a lot of effort, because this means that you don't only have to negotiate with the cultural authorities of your country to bring out a masterpiece, which is very complicated when you're trying to bring something precious and ancient. But you have to deal also with 28 countries, which is quite ambitious. But it is something which can possibly be done, and maybe the EU office could take the leadership for that. But it is extremely complicated. So now my ambition, since I know that I just have a few months left in Hong Kong, are to prepare a second exhibition. And if you really believe, and I'm sure you do, because otherwise you wouldn't be here today, that we are doing something useful and precious for the Hong Kong community, please say it, because we need some encouragement, not only funding, of course, but also some encouragement. The response to this exhibition has been very, very positive so far. We definitely want to do more to promote our culture, but not only our culture in general. And culture is the product of many different countries and civilizations. It cannot be the monopoly or the duopoly of a couple of countries. It must be culture, the cultural panorama, to be real, to be true, to be effective, must represent a variety of countries. If you have only one or a couple, then it's not enough, it's not true culture, it's partial culture.
Next question is coming from Tara Joseph, FCC's president.
Thank you so much for telling us about all of this. And I'm just curious, behind the romance and the beauty of the painting and bringing it here, it must have been very, very difficult to actually bring something of such value over. How long did it take, and how painful was it to actually make it happen?
Okay. It was quite painful sometimes. We worked night and day for this project. It was, at the end, it was less difficult than what we expected if we look at the Italian authorities, which were really enthusiastic about the project and really helped us. I mean, at the end, we organized this exhibition in only a few months. Normally, you take 1 or 2 years, at least 1 year, but probably also 2 years. We wanted to do it immediately when we learned that we had this chance to bring this masterpiece to Hong Kong, and then we kind of set a very precise and short deadline for ourselves. But yes, it has been quite a challenge and despairing sometimes to find venue, funding, and all the permissions. A lot of paperwork, but the paperwork at the end was the least complicated part. It's more difficult to find venues in Hong Kong. Of course, you don't have, at least for now, a lot of cultural venues. And so that was maybe the main challenge at the beginning. So I'm happy, I really believe and hope that this exhibition will pave the way for a different awareness to see the Hong Kong people asking for more.
It's quite shocking to know that you had great difficulty in finding a venue for Botticelli.
Put it right there.
Yes.
That's an idea.
Any other questions from the floor? Either about Botticelli. Ah, the lady over there on the left, please.
Grazie, Sandra. You know that I'm a very big fan of my Italian heritage and culture. One thing, I think it explains the story of Simonetta. It explains, I believe, Salman Rushdie's Enchantress of Florence, the story of Simonetta in that as well. But I could be wrong. My question is, how has the tourism from Hong Kong to Italy, going through your office, as you might see, mm-hmm. been increasing over the years? And is there more awareness of the Italian culture and the desire to travel to Italy to see the cultural aspects, not just shopping?
Okay, thank you. We Hong Kong people do not need a visa to come to Italy, and so I mean it's difficult to say yet, because normally the people who need a visa are, for example, the mainlanders, so who normally ask visas in the other consulates, Italian consulates in China. So we don't have let's say relevant data, but I do think that when you promote culture, you actually are promoting the whole country. I mean, to promote culture is the most effective way to brand a country, because you're really speaking directly to the hearts and minds of people. You're really saying, hey, this is my country. And I mean, this painting speaks so much of the culture of Italy, because it tells the history of a nation which has been founded on art and culture. You know, our identity is founded on that. And this is why Italian design or architecture or Italian fashion is so beautiful or successful, because it comes from all these great masters of the past and even to, the times of Rome. So I do not have data, about the touristic flows, but I'm sure that this is all positive. It does help. Also trade, also, a deeper awareness, more deeper bridges between the two societies. So it does help for sure, all aspects of bilateral relations.
Just wonder, how about the other move, the other direction? Are there a lot more Italians living in Hong Kong today compared to, say, 5 years ago? How many more?
Yeah. When I came here, so 3.5 years ago, we were 1,800 something. Now we are 2,800 officially registered. So it's a lot. It's a very big growth, and they continue to come. And then not only the dimension of the Italian community has changed, but also the composition of the Italian community. We have more and more, young people and young families, therefore having more children and enlarging the community. Young professionals who come here, whether in their 20s or 30s, right? Whereas before we had more people arriving here between their 40s and 50s, so they were a little bit more, let's say, mature in their career. So many, many more, and many more will come, I think, I'm sure.
Presumably it's to do with the difficulty of getting a job
back home, possibly?
Also, yeah, this is certainly, for sure, the economic crisis, let's say, is helping in this direction, but also because we, and I also think that after the signing of the agreement for the avoidance of double taxation, which was signed last January, this will help more Italian companies to come to Hong Kong rather than to other cities of China or of Asia. So yes, the crisis, the fact that the economic power is shifting to this part of the world, and the fact that our trade is improving, is growing, as I said before, and yes, and this agreement also. So.
Mm-hmm. Any questions for Alexandra about the history, the 500 years of Italian history in this part of the world, perhaps?
Maybe it's a cheeky question. The French came up last year with 150 years of Hong Kong-France relationship. Now Italy comes up with 500 years of Hong Kong-Italy friendship. Who can next beat you? Which country? I guess Portugal?
I have no idea, of course. It's up to them. I do not want to suggest them to also beat us.
So you hold the record for them.
But it was funny because when I talked with Arnaud last year, just before his book was coming out, and I told him I'm writing this book, and he was really looked at me and said, really, what are you doing, something like that? And he was, understandably surprised. Well, we did not write 500 years in the title because we wanted to be the French. It's simply we thought it was a nice title because, I mean, book, I'm not sure how many of you will read the book. I really hope all of you, or at least a big, big majority. But there is a message in the book. We are here, we have been here for a long time. So at least the title is quite effective in delivering the message. So it is true, and we wanted it to be quite immediate. So it's not for the famous healthy competition between Italians and their very close brothers or cousins, whatever you prefer. But it's really, we had the same idea, which proves that why we are neighbors.
Let me remind everyone that you can pick up your own complimentary copy of this book near the exit over there. We have time for one more question.
I'm always curious. A few months ago, we actually had a talk at the FCC about how it's so difficult for art to flourish in Hong Kong and why is Hong Kong so behind. But you mentioned that things came into place quite quickly, mm-hmm. although we have no venues that are appropriate for these types of exhibitions in Hong Kong. What's your sense? Do you think Hong Kong is really developing quickly into a place for art?
Well, I think Hong Kong is developing a lot. Since it is difficult to find venues, we wanted to really find something which was impossible to say no. I mean, when we proposed the Botticelli, all museums were interested. The thing is that, of course, each museum has a very long-standing program, a very old one, and then sometimes they cannot adjust very, very quickly. The reason why also we are bringing one piece only is, well, first of all, because it's easier to explain to the public. You just have to focus on one message instead of, a wider exhibition. And second, because we thought it would have been easier to find space and venue for only one piece rather than for 10 or 15 or 20 pieces or 30 or whatever. It was not easy. But yes, I think Hong Kong is developing. I hope it will develop much, much, faster. There is a sensibility maybe to cultivate and to help grow. Once again, we need your help. That is to say, it cannot be something imposed from above. It must be, and we wish it to be as a result of the dialogue. So the more the Hong Kong community has, and the Hong Kong press has a big responsibility in this, pushing the authorities to be more sensitive and building, more about education in terms of scientific education, but as the development of the human being, therefore humanities and studies like art and history are essential. The more this city will have a very bright future, because at the end, what distinguishes Hong Kong from other fast-growing cities in Asia? I mean, there are many, many cities which will, are threatening sometimes Hong Kong, or in any case, playing a very, very strong competition. In the end, it's the cosmopolitan character of this city. So the more you have a mixed culture, the more you have a cosmopolitan culture, the more you will keep your strength. That's my opinion, of course.
hear, hear. Thank you very much, Alexandra, for coming to the club today. I've got a little souvenir for you to take away.
Thank you so much.
Don't forget to pick up your book.
Oh, sure, of course, of course, of course.
Mm-hmm.